Welcome to the second session of the Anabaptist history. And today we want to cover the migrations from Europe to America. And I'm glad somebody put some maps over here. So what we're going to be looking at today is going from Europe over here to America. Part of that is, let's see, probably clear from about here over. And one little thing I might tell you just to begin with here. I think we're probably all acquainted with Conrad Grebel being the leader, one of the main leaders of the Anabaptists in Switzerland. It is said that when the persecution got real heavy there, after 1525, he just made the comment. He said, maybe we should go to where the Redskins are. Now that is interesting to me, that even Conrad Grebel was thinking about America. When I did this chart here, the one thing that really impressed me, and I don't know if you can, maybe you can't all see that, but on the world events, who do we think of as who discovered America? Who do we think of on that?
Christopher Columbus.
Christopher Columbus, in what year?
1492.
1492, and what year was the beginning of the Swiss Anabaptists? 1525. So how many years before the beginning of the Swiss Anabaptists was America discovered? 38, I think. Is that right, Mario? Yeah, about 38. Okay, so what you have here, 1525 is the beginning of the Swiss Brethren, and Columbus discovered America 38 years before that, but we don't have any of the Anabaptists actually immigrating until about right in here. And then we have a number of immigrations going all the way over here to 1943. So this is pretty much the time frame that we want to cover today. I thought I'd begin by reading just a little bit of Paul's experiences in writing to the Corinthians in 2 Corinthians 11. I'm going to read from verses 22 to 28. It's kind of cutting in and it's kind of cutting back out of what he had to say. But Paul also faced a lot of persecution. And so let me read that here. 2 Corinthians 11:22. Are they Hebrews? So am I. Are they Israelites? So am I. Are they the seed of Abraham? So am I. Are they ministers of Christ? I speak as a fool. I am more. And then this is pretty much what I wanted. In labors more abundant. In stripes above measure. In prisons more frequent. In deaths often. Of the Jews 5 times received I 40 stripes, save one. Thrice was I beaten with rods. Once I was stoned. Thrice I suffered shipwreck. A night and a day have I been in the deep. In journeyings often. In perils of waters. In perils of robbers. In perils by mine own countrymen, in perils by the heathen, in perils in the city, in perils in the wilderness, in perils in the sea, in perils among false brethren, in weariness and painfulness, in watchings often, in hunger and thirst, in fastings often, in cold and nakedness, beside those things that are without, that which cometh upon me daily, the care of all the churches. So the Anabaptists experienced very severe persecutions. But look at all that Paul went through, all the beatings and the prison and the shipwrecks, all this for the sake of the gospel. Now, I was going to have you turn to something in our handout, but you know what? We didn't hand them out. So let's get that done. On. Now I'm going to get two more here.
what I'd like to have you do is turn
the first page is our outline for the day. I would like to have you turn to the back side of that front page. Everything else is just one page. But I thought this was an interesting, worthwhile quote from Harold S. Bender. He said this: "It is not that Mennonites do not love the soil or have no sense of home and homeland, nor is it that they have not loved the men and women of the lands in which they have lived, or that they were unwilling to stay and carry on even after difficult circumstances. It was a hostile world around them which would not tolerate them, which forced them to go, which was unwilling to let them stay and maintain a faith and a spirit which was a challenge to its own system." Okay, then if you look at the second page here, we have here the migrations from Europe to America, and there's about 8 waves, and we'll be going over that in a little more detail. But these people left their homeland. Why? And it was basically for the gospel. It was for freedom of religion. It was because it wasn't necessarily that they could move somewhere and make a better living. There was maybe a little bit of that. But it was that they weren't wanted where they were. And so they became fugitives in this world in which we live. And, you know, we never know when we might have to pull up stakes and do the same thing sometime. You have to wonder about that sometime. All right, now, if you want to look at the first page there, the outline, we've got major migrations from Europe to America from 1683 to 1943, and I already showed you where that is on the timeline. There are a number of reasons why they immigrated. One, of course, we've talked about persecution. Another one was for economic reasons, and there again, not so much to get a bigger paycheck, but because of poverty. They could hardly make it. They weren't allowed to own their own land. And in one place I read, there was in 1708 and 09, there was an extremely harsh winter, and men and animals and trees died, and they could just hardly live there. There were hardships. Taxation was a heavy burden. The government learned to tax they couldn't own land. They wanted freedoms, but one way they would give them military exemption was a very, very hard or a very heavy tax. Of course, freedom of worship was a very big thing. Maybe I'll say this here. I think I plan to say this a little bit tomorrow, but it is interesting how that once these brothers and sisters immigrated to America, they were so thankful that they had a place where they could worship the Lord as they believed it was right. And even to today, I think there is a thread of that that comes through. I remember my father was a minister. Often in his prayers, he would thank the Lord that we can worship him unhindered and unmolested. You ever heard that? Something along that line? That comes from our forebears who came from Europe and were severely persecuted, and they came to a new world where they were unhindered and unmolested in their worship of God. There were wars. The 30-year war, right here, there were armies that swept through Europe back and forth. They were carrying religion, you might say. So the Catholics would get a hold of it. And then the Protestants would gain, and I don't know a lot about the 30-Year War, but this was very difficult. Some of the areas where the Anabaptists lived were ravaged. There were political concerns. There was military conscription, and I'm going to at the end of the class, I've got several papers I'd like to go over with you. And what that is just kind of my own personal digging of what has happened in my family, where they've come from, and so on. And so my grandfather Roth, which would have been my mother's father, he came across as a 7-year-old boy with his family. I think there were seven or five boys and two girls. My great-grandfather, who came with his family, if I am not mistaken, was 68 years old. Why would a 68-year-old man leave his homeland and take his family, clear across the ocean, and start over again? I wondered that. But as I've studied the history, I really think, he had five boys. What's going to happen to these five boys when they get to military age? They're going to be called to serve in the, whether it was the German or the French or the Swiss Army or whatever it was. They would have lived in Alsace, just across the border from Basel, Switzerland. And I might get to that just a little bit later here. Okay, and then I have number 7 there, family. And I've run onto this sometimes where, you know, maybe a son or a daughter had immigrated, and or parents had, and the married son and daughter, but they'd like to be where family is. The approximate numbers, it's rather interesting, and the first migrations, which we'll find, were mainly Swiss. And then later, it's going to be mainly Dutch. But the approximate numbers of immigrants between these several centuries was around 9,200 Swiss and 46,100 Dutch. Dutch being from Holland or the Netherlands. Major point number 2 is that the immigrants were Mennonite, mainly Mennonite to begin with, and later mainly Amish. But there were Mennonites and Amish, and if you read about some of their immigrations, some of them would not ride on the same ship. If that's a Mennonite ship, here come the Amish, we're not going to go with you, or vice versa. Really strong feelings yet, as far as division. So now let's look a little bit at the places of settlement. And if you want to go to this page here, we have Pennsylvania. And as you're probably well aware, Pennsylvania, the name of Pennsylvania comes from Penn's Woods. William Penn was granted a grant of land to pay a debt that the King of England owed his father. And so he gave this land to William. I'm not sure what the king had in mind for him to do with that. But William Penn wanted to have what he called a holy experiment. And he was opening it up for all religious groups that wanted to come and have freedom of worship. He was a Quaker. A lot of people that came were Quakers. There were a lot of Mennonites. There were Lutheran. There were Catholics. There were, I don't know what all there. Reform. But it was an open door for the Mennonites. And again, to think that God was looking ahead, what was it, a couple centuries, when America was discovered, that there would be a place for his people to go and find rest and to find fulfillment in their Christian lives. So the first, I guess one thing that became a little bit clearer to me this time in studying, I've kind of known it, but the first wave, if you can kind of keep this wave thing in mind, the first wave was from the Lower Rhine. And I think that would be in this general area somewhere. The Rhine River runs from Basel, Switzerland, on up into Holland. Whoops, just a minute here. And somewhere in this general area, and I'm not quite sure, I should have looked at a map for sure, is where the first ones immigrated from. They were Dutch. They were not Swiss. They had come out of Holland from the persecutions in Holland. And most of them were actually Quakers. There were a few Mennonites, and the few Mennonites that were there kind of converted to Quakerism. They settled in Germantown, which is today would be a suburb of Philadelphia. And there was one family at least that stayed Mennonite, and they began to have their own services. But their services were in Dutch. Well, then there were a number of Swiss families that came from 1683 to 1709, about 25 years. There were about 40 Mennonite families that came to Germantown. And when the Mennonite families came to Germantown, they were Swiss. And they talked the German? I'm not sure if it was Platt Dutch. I don't think it was Platt Dutch. The German. And so it was a little bit hard for them to get their services together, because those at Germantown were the Dutch and the others were German. And so they began to spread out from Germantown into what became known as the Shippack area, later known as Franconia. And on this map here, the green is where they would have settled: Bucks County, Montgomery, Chester, Berks, Lehigh, Northampton. That all became part of what was known as the Shippack or the Franconia settlement. Then there was, I think it was in 1710, there were a number of that came directly from Europe and settled in the Lancaster area. Anybody know what the town of Lancaster was called in those days? Hickorytown. I'm not sure why. but anyhow, that's what it was called, and they settled there. And Lancaster, it seemed that, and in some ways probably Franconia too, but Lancaster seemed to be a stronghold of the Mennonite church. It was here where new innovations were hard to come by. I mean, they held to the faith and the practice of their forefathers. And there was fertile land there, and they really began to prosper. But you know, a lot of the efforts of these earlier immigrants went into taming the land, into clearing the land, into farming. In fact, in those earlier days, they would have only had church services probably about every 4 weeks. And if you happen to show up tomorrow, we might talk about that a little bit more. If you don't, that's all right. Still go ahead and talk about it. All right. So then they begin to, from Lancaster here and so on, they begin to settle in other areas of the York, Adams, Cumberland, Lebanon, Oneida counties, probably Snyder, so on, but I just have those marked. And that became the area of the Lancaster Conference. Over in the southwest part, in blue, that was, I don't have my geography real good, and you Pennsylvania folks can maybe help me out, but if I understand right, that would be west of the Alleghenies. Is that correct? Anyhow, this was an area that was not opened up because of the French and Indian War. The Pennsylvania government asked settlers not to go into that area for a time, and then it became a place that could be settled. We have Franklin County here, and actually we should have Maryland, below that where the Washington Franklin County Conference was, and you ladies would know a little bit about that. Do you live in Maryland or Pennsylvania? Just right on the line, so you go back and forth across. Yeah. So I'm sorry, if I'd have known you were going to be here, I might have put Washington County in there too. But that just gives you a little idea of that. And then if you follow on through here, I have listed Maryland, and actually Virginia shows settled before Maryland. And I'm going to have you turn to the next page of the U.S., and the dates of these different ones. And actually, Maryland was more or less of a route that settlers took from Pennsylvania to Virginia, and maybe didn't really settle in Maryland right away, if I would understand right. I should have... I don't think I have that here. There was the settlers in Virginia. There were quite a few that went there, and they had peaceable relationships with the Indians there. But at a certain point then, there was a white man that came with the Indians, got the Indians all stirred up, and they just came and destroyed a lot of the white settlers and their homes. There was a Rhodes family. Now, we often hear about the Hot Settler Massacre, but there was a Rhodes family where they were killed right at their home setting. I think the father and the mother. There was a older daughter who took a younger daughter and ran to the barn. And while a Indian went to get fire to start that on fire, she slipped out through the hemp. I think it was the hemp crop, and escaped about 12 miles to her brother's place. There was a boy that climbed a tree to see what was going on, and they shot him out of the tree. There was another boy that went and was crossing the creek, and they killed him there. And I think that's called Bloody Run, Bloody something to this day. So they had a terrible massacre there, and a lot of them went back to Pennsylvania. And then as things settled down, then the settlers came back into Virginia later. Then I have Canada listed in 1786. Can anyone help me or tell me why the Mennonites in the U.S., in America, found Canada to be a place to go or an attractive place to go? Do you have any idea on that? What was behind that?
They promised England that they would be loyal to them.
That's right. England had been so good to them and given them these freedoms, and they would have promised their allegiance to the King of England. Now how could they go against that? And actually, because of that, they were kind of looked at as Tories or that they were, what would you say, not really rebels, but...
Loyalists.
Yeah, they were loyalists. And so a number of Mennonites moved into Ontario, Canada because of that. That probably wasn't the only reason. I mean, it's a good area there, and they moved in there. And I have that as 1786. Okay, then if you look here, Ohio is the next one west, and it shows the Mennonites went in there in 1799. Ohio is a kind of interesting state. Now, in the one book I read, it was the first state in the Northwest for Mennonite to go into. So that was the Northwest then. Now, the Northwest has moved a lot further west. So it became the 17th state in 1803, about 4 years after the first Mennonites grew there. And I don't know, you know, close to Carbondale, Ohio, I went to Bible school at Carbondale, and there's a little town there, Lancaster. And that was founded by some Mennonites that moved in there from, guess where? From Lancaster. And Ohio just exploded as far as population. In 1810, in Ohio, there was 42,000 people. 10 years later, in 1820, there were 230,760 people. So an explosion there, and the Mennonites also, many of them came there. So they came from various places. They came from Pennsylvania, they came from Virginia, they came from Maryland, they came from, I'm not sure just where all. Here, you be glad to let you follow along here. And there were some direct immigrations right into Ohio itself. And I don't have a good handle on that. I know that there's a group of Swiss in Ohio that would have roots right back to Switzerland. I have listed here Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Missouri, and you can kind of see the progression. They just kept moving further west. Indiana is an interesting settlement, and there's so many things that happened in Indiana, and that gets us to our discussion tomorrow, as far as the progressive moves that the church made and the holding back of the more conservative ones and so on. So this little map here, and I was kind of wondering, this is something I used in Bible school teaching. I kind of wondered, why did I pick out these different states? Colorado, Idaho, Oregon, Washington, Alberta. Oh, then it dawned on me. I don't think so. we can stop if we need to. That is the state that I had students. And I thought it would be interesting, you know, from Washington, from Idaho, from... And I got to thinking, why don't I have Saskatchewan there? Because it was pretty well settled, I think, about the same time as Alberta. But it does show the westward movement of the Mennonites. And, of course, I'm a lot more acquainted with the history here in Oregon. In 1876. So my father and his family, my father was 8 months old when they moved here in 1909, so there hadn't been Mennonites here very long until my grandfather would have moved here.
That was a false alert.
You know what? We figured that out.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, I'm going to stop right there as far as immigration, and I'd like to jump ahead to my little bunny trail. If you want to look at the my ancestors. Okay, so my grandfather Schrock is the first one that's listed. The Yorty family, my grandmother on the Schrock side was Yorty. Okay, my mother's father was Nicholas Roth, and her mother was Reschle. So that kind of gives you. And I got to. And one reason I'm showing this, maybe some of you would like to dig out some of the same things in your own background. You know, where did your ancestors come? When did they come? And I really found this interesting, that all of my ancestors that would have come from the Alsace-Lorraine area. And I mentioned this yesterday, that this man in Poland asked me what my nationality was. And I said, well, German. You're not German. He could tell looking at me that I didn't have characteristics of a German, because he sits right beside him, and he's been hammered from the Germans on one side and the Russians on the other. These Polish people have. And so that got me to look. Well, yeah, so my ancestry goes back to Switzerland. My Swiss ancestors moved into the Alsace-Lorraine area, and they came across to America as Amish. Now, when we think of Amish, we think of Old Order. Not here. This was not Old Order. And that needs to be explained more. Tomorrow I'd like to go through the Amish line there. So I'd like for you to compare, if you can, the major migrations. And that's the second sheet. And if you see here, the third wave was 1815 to 1860. And that was basically all Amish that came to Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, and Ontario. Now, if you go back to my little chart, my personal little chart, you'll find the first two went to Illinois during that time period, and also the Reschles went to Ontario during that time period. But the Roths, they were later. They came in 1891. You go back to the chart, I guess they came in wave four. And no. No, wave five. Wave five would have been a smaller wave, but they came to Ohio, Indiana, Illinois, Ontario. But they came to Iowa, actually. So I found that very interesting to find that the four legs of my ancestry came from Alsace-Lorraine in these times of the waves. Now, something else I'd like to point out to you. On the immigration, so here we have wave one, and here we have wave two, which is Mennonites, 3,000 to 4,500, and about 500 Amish. And those would have come, I think, mainly to Pennsylvania. Yes, mainly to Pennsylvania. Okay, then wave three, we get. You know what? No, here it is. Yeah, because it was Amish. Look at that time difference from 1756 to 1815. There was just quite a gap where there was hardly any immigration. Anybody know why?
Wars.
Wars. You know which ones?
French and Indian and Revolutionary and then the Napoleonic Wars.
Exactly. So I don't have the French and Indian. I thought I did it here.
It's right there.
Oh, it sure is. It's about the, okay, the French and Indian, and the Revolutionary War, and the Napoleon War. And in this time frame, basically no immigration because it stopped them coming. I think that's interesting to take a look at. I said that wave five is where my grandfather Roth came.
and that's right here. Wave 6, I put that there partially because the 400 are still Swiss, but 18,000 are Dutch. And those Swiss was a group that had moved to Galatia and Poland and then later to America. So over here, just to get a picture. All right, so what we have, I was talking about the Alsace-Lorraine area. We are right in this area. And I have a picture of the ship that my grandfather came over on. They would have lived right here in the Basel fishermen. They took a train from there to Le Havre, France. And from there, I think it was to New York. And then their passage was from there to Burlington, Iowa. And that's how that family traveled.
Now, let's look just a little bit. I thought you might just find this interesting. And I hope you did, because I had to get special permission to copy this picture for you folks. It's a picture that I got a number of years back from the, I think it's the Maritime Museum in Newport News, Virginia. And on the back, not to be copied. And so I sent a little email, and I'm going to be teaching this class, could I copy it? And very nice. They sent me and said, okay, no charge. But anyhow, this is a picture of the ship that the Roth family in, what did I say, it was in 91, was it? Yes, 1891 would have come across. They would have come across third class. There's first class, there's second class, and there's third class. Now, and there's a little bit about that steamship behind there. Now, I got ahead of myself.
I want to read you something.
Let's see if I can find. Okay. I'd like to read you just a little bit about these ships that sail. I think this would be probably more the earlier ones, not so much the one that I have a picture of here. But I'd like to just read out of this, the Swiss Anabaptist for a little bit here. And it has the perilous voyage. The voyage to America was by no means an easy undertaking. The voyage from southern Germany to Rotterdam, a city at the mouth of the Rhine River, took 4 to 6 weeks. So if they went from southern Germany up here to Rotterdam, 4 to 6 weeks to get up there. All right. Because Germany was at that time divided into states, travelers had to pass through 36 custom houses. Many of these custom houses subjected the immigrants to such undue excise taxes that by the time they reached Holland, many Mennonites were nearly penniless. If you ever go to Europe and take a Rhine River tour, a boat ride, on both sides of the river there are castles. And each one of those castles had its lord, and anybody that would go by the river, they had to stop and pay tax to get through there. It was just like a toll. And what did it say? 36, I think. All right. From Rotterdam, the voyage to Philadelphia took approximately 3 months. During the voyage, there is on board these ships terrible misery, stench, fumes, horror, vomiting, many kinds of sickness, all of which came from old and sharply salted meats, also very bad and foul water, that many die of misery. That's a quote. Also, children from 1 to 7 years rarely survive the journey. Many times the parents are compelled to see their children die of hunger, thirst, and sickness, and then see them cast into the water. Few women in confinement escape with their lives. Many a mother is cast into the water with her child. Other deprivations were encountered, such as cold and dampness. Lice was so plentiful especially on the sick, that they could be scraped from their bodies. Another factor contributed to disease was the presence of rats aboard the ships. Sickness and dizziness also prevailed when the comparatively small sailing vessels were exposed to ocean gales that rocked and rolled them for 2 or 3 days. Sometimes the gales were so severe that people tumbled over each other, and few had any hope that the ship would not sink to the bottom. Sea robbers and pirates also present a danger. Another circumstance that made voyages unhealthy was the crowding. One writer stated that greedy sailing merchants packed the immigrants like herring. Nobody will ever know how many died at sea, but 1/3 is considered a conservative figure, and 1/2 is probably nearer the truth. And so the question is asked, why did the Mennonites continue to brave this dangerous voyage? The answer is they felt God was leading them to a land where they would enjoy religious liberty. So I think we can be very thankful that these brave people, they did that. They went on these ships and went across and came here to the New World. All right, I'd like to talk just a little bit yet before they tell me it's time to quit about the last point there, the settlements by the Russian Mennonites in the Prairie States, Canadian provinces, Paraguay, Brazil, Uruguay, and Mexico. And you know, South America is also America. But we have here then, right here on the sixth wave, 18,000 that came from, Russia. We have 21,000 that came to Canada. And then after World War II, another 7,000 to Canada and some to South America. So let's talk just a little bit about what happened. These Dutch immigrants had gone from Prussia, or what would today be Poland, basically, to Russia at the invitation of Catherine the Great. And they were offered to come and to have their own lands, to have their own government, to have their own schools, and to have their own farms. And they really prospered financially and numerically. They spread out. We said yesterday that there were 4 original colonies and two of them would have been in the Ukraine. Maybe over here would be Ukraine, and then there were 2 of them more over in here. And so they got along fine, it seemed like, until a certain point. In about 1870, there was something that came up that really concerned the Mennonites, and that was that the Russian government threatened to withdraw military exemption from the Mennonites, although it had been originally promised forever. And then there was a form of alternate service that was worked out, and many of them felt, okay, they'll stay, they've got their houses and the lands here. But the confidence had been shaken. And so there were some that said, you know, we probably better get out while getting good. And so there were 18,000 of them that immigrated to the Prairie States and to Manitoba. Have any of you ever been in Manitoba and where the Mennonites are? You drive into the town of Steinbeck, and there's just a whole, the churches of Steinbeck welcome you. And I think all of them Mennonite, but 2. It's amazing. Someone has told me, and it's probably true, in the Winnipeg area, it's the largest Mennonite settlement in America, much larger than Lancaster in Winnipeg. So, and you can kind of see with this many people going there. Okay, let's go on then. By the time of the First World War, the Mennonites in Russia numbered about 100,000. That would have been include unbaptized children. The colonies were well organized. They had their own schools or hospitals or charitable institutions. Their farms were showpieces of Russia. Then came the Bolshevik Revolution. Anybody know what date that was?
1917.
Right, 1917. And that came, and then the communists took over, and then there was a lot of terror, there was a lot of just a lot of things that went on there. And so at that time, about 21,000 were able actually to migrate to Canada, and another 4,000 to South America, going to Paraguay and Brazil. Then after World War II, a lot of the Mennonite people went with the German army back into Germany in the hopes of getting out of Russia, and about two-thirds of them were, the Russians took them back in, and they kind of, we don't know for sure what will happen to them. But at that time then, there was about 12,000 that were able to leave Europe. Canada received 7,000, and about 5,000 went to Paraguay. Then maybe just a footnote to that might be interesting to you. The Mennonites who went to Canada weren't completely satisfied how they were being treated with their schools. Canada was trying to take away their right to teach in the German language. And so I don't think I have the date here, but I think it was in the early 1920s. There's about 10,000 of them moved to Mexico, and there's a large settlement of Mennonites there in Mexico, and some to Paraguay at that time too. Let me read this once more, this statement from Harold S. Bender. It's not that Mennonites do not love the soil or have no sense of home and homeland, nor is it that they have not loved the men and women of the lands in which they have lived, or that they were unwilling to stay and carry on even after difficult circumstances. It was a hostile world around them which would not tolerate them, which forced them to go, which was unwilling to let them stay and maintain a faith and a spirit which is a challenge to its own system. And so that brings us to why there are so many Mennonites in America today. And I'm so thankful that God has opened the door for us and allowed us to live here. And so then that brings us to the point of, okay, so we're here, everything's going good. Now we find fault with each other, we're going to split, we're going to go a lot of different ways. All right, thank you for your attention.